listening to the only daily talk show in North America covering the world of football. This is World Football Daily.
Yes, 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 yes! It hits the back of the net! Oh my goodness me!
The world's game.
Oh, you're beautiful! What a headshot! What a head!
Our religion.
Brilliant goal! What an equalizer!
Our passion.
Go, go, USA! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
World Football Daily serves up the best football talk 5 days a week.
Oh, oh, you will never, ever see a game quite like this! Unbelievable!
Suarez shines for Liverpool, but he's not as bright as Manchester United. Javier Hernandez provides the goal that gives David Moyes a little bit of respite as his Red Devils get a 1-0 win in the Capital One Cup against Liverpool. It's all good for the LA Galaxy, a 3-0 win in Costa Rica for the LA side in CONCACAF Champions League football last night. Fatih Terim is axed from Galatasaray. We will be talking all about the iconic Turkish manager's time with Galatasaray and his unfortunate dismissal just 4 games in to the Turkish season. Is that worse than Di Canio? It is kind of like losing, I guess, Sir Alex Ferguson after he goes back to Manchester United and then gets dismissed after 4 games. I mean, unbelievable. Welcome to Thursday's edition of World Football Daily. I'm Oliver the Deuce Wilson, bringing you the news and the views from around the world of football. Catch up with our podcast on worldfootballdaily.com. I'm sure the Turkish podcast this week will be cracking on with the dismissal of Fatih Terim and what that means for Galatasaray. We're going to do the exact same thing here on an action-packed show here on World Football Daily today. Joining us a little later on is Brian Dunseth. He'll be talking to us about Major League Soccer and, of course, CONCACAF Champions League as well. We'll be breaking down a little bit of the LA Galaxy's win last night. The Dynamo as well, getting a comfortable 2-0 win at home as they secure their spot in the final stages of the CONCACAF Champions League, or well, almost, not quite, sorry, because they do have to still take on Arabe Unido from Panama, and then they will have secured their spot in the Champions League knockout stages. Sporting Kansas City are almost there as well. They just need a draw or better against Olympia in their final game. Cruz Azul on top of Group 3, Club America just on top of Group 4, but the two sides below them, Sporting San Miguelito and Alajuelense, play each other tonight, and the winner of that could upset Club America's party just a little bit, depending on goal difference and depending on how America do against Alajuelense in their final game of the competition. Heredia sit above the Montreal Impact and San Jose Earthquakes in Group 5, but the San Jose Earthquakes can still qualify with a 1-0 win against Heredia in their final game. Toluca sit on top of Group 6. Group 7 has Tijuana already through. The LA Galaxy booked their place last night with their 3-0 win against Cartaginés. As I say, Brian Dunseth will be talking to us all about CONCACAF Champions League. But joining me now today on the show, our first guest for the day, and here to talk a little bit about the major stories out of European football. We are going to try and avoid English football a fair bit. I want to avoid Serie A as much as possible, and I'm hoping that Rafa doesn't bring up AC Milan's 3-3 draw with Bologna from yesterday. Tonight we have Inter Fiorentina, but to talk a little bit about Real Madrid and a little bit about Turkish football as well is a man joining us on the line today. He is already in waiting. He's a man who we love to get into the finer details and the darkest holes of European football with. We're going to keep it big star with him today, though, and keep it with some of the major leagues and not try and catch him off his guard. He is, of course, Mr. Andy Brassel, joining us here on World Football Daily. Andy, man, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, as always. How are you?
Thanks very much, Ollie. How are you?
I'm very well indeed, very well indeed. Recovering from a couple of late nights of sleep, but I think as long as you know, you're so entertaining, Andy, on the show, I think it's going to help me stay awake, that's for sure, mate, that's for sure.
Let's hope so.
Let's get straight down into some of the major stories from European football this week, and really, what was quite a big story this week and has continued into the latter stages of this week has been Turkish football and the I want to say altercations, but it was a lot more than just an altercation on the pitch between fans. Beşiktaş against Galatasaray. obviously a big rivalry between these two sides from Istanbul and Turkish football, but this is so much more than just a football riot, isn't it, Andy?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's been notable in the days since is quite a lot of support for the Beşiktaş fans from Galatasaray fans, because, you know, there's been a feeling that perhaps it was something that was politically staged discredit Beşiktaş. And of course, there was such incredible unity between fans of the big three. It was such a bitter rival, Beşiktaş and Bahrain, Galatasaray, in the political demonstrations that lasted in Istanbul over the summer. So what I think is great, obviously it's a not great situation socially and politically for the people of Istanbul and for Beşiktaş as a club. What is great is that the fans of these three clubs who have had myriad differences over the years, but they seem to still be standing together.
It's very peculiar to see them standing together on this sort of situation, as you say, Andy, because there has been such a divide. When you look, what do you think is going to be the escalation from this in any way, shape or form? I mean, is this going to be actually seen as a bonding for these two sets of fans, or for the kind of the near future and the extended future?
Well, I would like to think so. I spoke to Fatty Turin, as you maybe were earlier this year, a couple of months back, for the Blizzard, and you know, he was saying one of the things that had to change in Turkish football was, you know, the bitterness of the rivalry, particularly the one between Fenerbahce and Galatasaray, where of course you've had all sorts of unedifying violence. You've had no away fans in Istanbul derbies for, well, now it's the third season in a row, which is obviously very, very sad, because it's a great showpiece and football is about fans and, you know, a rivalry within acceptable boundaries. And, you know, he said when he was a player, the players and the fans used to go to dinner together after the game. And he said, we really urgently, I think is the word he used, have to get back to those times. So, I mean, obviously it would be better if it wasn't a situation like this that goes far beyond football and, you know, goes into people's civil liberties and something far more important than football. Nevertheless, football often is like society in microcosm. So if, you know, this could, something good could come out of it, that would be great.
I don't want to sound like a broken record, Andy, but I mean, is this just another kind of method that shows that the changing face of football, with the players being so removed from the fans, etc., as the years have gone on, has actually been so detrimental? Do you think this sort of attitude of, if fans and players were able to mix after games and fans could feel far more involved with their clubs, do you think that would work across Europe and across the world in ways of stamping out these sorts of violent scenes that we're used to seeing and the aggression in football?
To be honest, I understand what you're saying about polarisation of players from the fans, but I don't really think that's necessarily something that needs to be part of it for the fans to feel close to their club and, you know, for fans to make the most of getting involved in their club. Mm. There are lots of ways you can do that. There are lots of clubs where people do. And of course, where is the players making the visible face of the club on the pitch? They come and go, but they're not really that important. You know, we keep going, whether our team sell their star player or buy rubbish ones or whatever. You know, you're just stuck with the team you support, and that's the end of it, really. And, you know, the experience of supporting the club, you know, is about, you know, the emotion you feel no matter what players are on the pitch, and, you know, the experience of going to the game and, you know, enjoying the whole day, really. So, for me, the players aren't really connected to that. Well, I suppose it would be nice, especially for younger fans, if there was more of a closeness and more of an accessibility to players. But personally, it's not something I see as hugely essential to the general experience of being a football fan.
Now, you touched on Fatih Terim there, and it's not been a great week for him. Fatih dismissed as Galatasaray's coach. How big a step is this? I mean, Fatih was only brought in really as kind of the interim manager, if you will, but he is such an iconic figure in Turkish football, being removed from really an iconic club, but it's not been the best start either from Galatasaray this season.
It has been a little slow, but I'm not sure you can really stack up a sporting reason for firing him. I mean, you know, you've got two leagues, two Super Cups, Champions League quarterfinal in two seasons. Bear in mind, the season before he took over, I think it was 11. You know, this was a club, a giant club, in absolute disarray before he came back. He reinstilled discipline and pride, and as is his way, playing really great attacking football. A lot of Galatasaray fans are very despondent about this, and you know, I completely understand them, because not just because someone who puts so much in and loves the club so much has been taken away from it and had it taken away from him, but just how are they going to get anyone better? How are they going to get anyone who gets the club better? And I think a lot of people there on the ground in Turkey just thinking, well, you know, what is this obsession we've got with overseas coaches? And you know, look at the names linked to the club. There's not a Turkish name in there. They want a big name just to try and appease the fans. And you know, you wonder, are people really going to have a grasp of the team, have a grasp of Turkish culture and Turkish football culture? And I think that is really important, because of course Galatasaray have a lot of overseas players and a lot of high-profile overseas players. That's clear. But I think what Turin did really well, especially in his first spell, and also in his second spell, is sort of ally really good domestic players with top overseas names, and you know, not just by Turkey's all there for the money, but you know, getting players like Drogba, you know, someone who can really lead by example, a real legend of the game. And of course, he was moving it on, bringing Bruma in. You know, that was a real step forward, I think, for the Turkish game in general, because they were bringing in a young player who's coveted by Premier League clubs, by Spanish clubs, and you know, someone who could go on to be a real world star, rather than just, you know, someone who's maybe at the back end of their career looking for a big payday. So I can understand why the fans are concerned, A, because Turin is an iconic figure, and B, because you have to worry about, you know, what is the direction of the club. And you know, they've been in a great position before. If you go back to the last time they were in the Champions League quarterfinals in 2001, the year after they won the UEFA Cup against Arsenal, of course. And you know, they had a terrific team then, and it all fell apart. So you know, you need to know there's real stability and real direction. Otherwise, they could, you know, dig themselves back into a hole pretty quickly.
You can get more thoughts on Turkish football on the Turkish Football Podcast on worldfootballdaily.com. Andy, we'll move away from Turkish football now, and even we won't get onto the topic of comparing Fatih Terim's dismissal to Paolo Di Canio's, even less games for Terim, of course. Only the four after the game between Beşiktaş and Galatasaray was abandoned after that crowd control incident. Let's have a look at Real Madrid just quickly. Last night, it was pretty much a get-out-of-jail-free card for Madrid yesterday evening. Pepe goes down after he seems to be manhandling his defender. And we're used to hearing Jose Mourinho and Madrid talking about the fix being in for Barcelona from UEFA. Now Gerard Piqué and Barcelona saying that Real Madrid are getting a bias from referees. Do you genuinely feel, we hear it all the time with Manchester United, that Madrid do get the luck of the draw when it comes to refereeing decisions in Spain?
I think you have to look at the particular where you made this decision. You gave some very, very favourable decisions to Barcelona in their home game against Sevilla a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, if anything, you know, if you think this referee is biased, you know, he's helped Barcelona as much as he's helped Madrid, because of course he chalked off what was looking like a good winning goal for Sevilla. And Barcelona went straight up the other end and scored the winner there in stoppage time there at the Camp Nou. But I think what was the most concerning thing about this decision, I mean, it's such a bad decision that even Mata, who, you know, no one's in any doubt where their sympathies lie, said Pep conned the referee. mean, if they're saying that, it's bad. It's really bad. And of course, you know, a club like Elche as well, who are not expected to stay up, having got a last minute equaliser against Real Madrid, having played a very, very good game, made them very uncomfortable. You know, it's the cruelest twist possible. So, in the context of where it happened, who it happened against, the point of the game it happened, it's very, very unedifying.
When you look at the Elche performance, as you say, it was a very good performance and a really beautifully worked goal for Boake to find the equaliser on 90 minutes. Will there be teams that will be looking at this Elche performance and seeing how they can break down and shut down Real Madrid? Because there's been so much talk about them being all-powerful Los Blancos this year with signing Bale and whatnot. But there's still plenty of ways, it seems, to slow down their moves forward and for lesser teams to really pick them off.
I think so. But for me, Ollie, the most interesting thing will be when we come to the Madrid derby on Saturday, because Real Madrid just looked so open under Ancelotti on the whole. And, you know, they're going to come out and attack that game. It's Bale's home debut. He's going to be very keen to have a go as well. And because of Atleti going there and winning the cup final at the Bernabeu back in May, you know, maybe they feel that really they didn't beat Real Madrid for so long. Maybe they feel now that's broken, you know, they can step up and play against them with a little more confidence. And so many Madrid derbies, Atleti have just retreated into their shell. So I guess well, there are two questions. One, will Atleti be able to stand up and reproduce the sort of quality of performance that they've started the season with? Because they've been very, very impressive. And two, I guess, you know, will they be able to take advantage of the openness of Real Madrid, or will, because they come out and have a go, will that give Real Madrid more of an opportunity to get after them?
I'm sure there'll be plenty of Atletico Madrid fans who will be hoping for a repeat of the Copa del Rey final from last May. It was an unbelievable game and an unbelievable moment for Atletico Madrid fans. Madrid do look exposed under Ancelotti. Andy, we're going to have to leave it there. I apologise for it being such a short chat today. We would love to have you on for a little longer, but I'm afraid the world just has, football just doesn't stop, unfortunately, and neither can we here at World Football Daily. We really appreciate you taking a bit of time out to have a chat with us today, though, mate, and especially to fill us in on Galatasaray and Fatih Terim and what this club is going to do now with this iconic manager gone. And we look forward to catching up with you very soon indeed, mate.
Take care. See you
Cheers,
soon.
Andy. Have a very good day. Andy Brassel there joining us here on World Football Daily, talking a little bit of Fatih Terim here on WFD. Very brief there from Andy, but the reason why we're being brief is because we have our next guest for the show lined up, ready and waiting. He's on a bit of a tight schedule, but I'm delighted to say that joining me now here on World Football Day to talk a little bit of CONCACAF Champions League and, of course, Major League Soccer as well is the one, the only, Mr. Brian Dunseth here on WFD. Brian, man, how are you doing today? Been a busy day for you travelling, I hear.
Yeah, man, first flight out. I up at 4 a.m. trying to get the first plane home and spend at least what looks to be at least 24 hours at home before I head up to Vancouver. So always good to be on the loose.
I was going to say, football never stops, so I guess it kind of means that you're not allowed to either, right?
Not at all. But as I always say, the swindle continues. I've got the dream job, and they're going to have to pry this job out of my fingers because I'm not giving this one up.
Always good to hear somebody who not only works in football for a living but absolutely loves it as well. I'm sure, Brian, the LA Galaxy were loving last night, booking their place into the final rounds, the knockout stages of CONCACAF Champions League. My question to you, though, Brian, first, before we analyse the Galaxy's performance, is how can a team like the LA Galaxy take a reserve team to Costa Rica and win on the road, yet the US men's national team, a stronger team, can go to Costa Rica and balls things up so badly?
You know, it's a great question. And I think what it boils down to is, you know, Bruce Arena historically in this tournament has primarily used a younger lineup. And in particular, since CONCACAF changed the format to only four games, home and away, with some breakup dates in there, the LA Galaxy started their first two games at home. It was a little bit of a tainted schedule because of their commitment to being a super club, to being the flagship bearer for this league and playing in international tournaments in the summer. So it condensed their schedule, made it a little bit more difficult, and I think ultimately forced Bruce Arena to continue with that philosophy of playing young guys on the road in CONCACAF Champions League, because he had to save guys like Landon, save guys like Robbie Keane, even an Omar Cummings and company, to make sure that they did everything possible to prepare for this final run-up to MLS. So very, very difficult. Great result on the road. Jack McBean continues to develop as a young player against international competition. And it's good to see a guy like Chandler Hoffman get his first goal for the Galaxy on the road. And what you said was a very tough place to play.
Now, obviously the Galaxy sweeping past Cartaginés last night away from home in Costa Rica. That 3-0 win, very comfortable indeed. And the young players, do you think they show more than they maybe would do if they were getting intermittent time a lot in Major League Soccer, because they know that the CONCACAF Champions League is their chance to shine?
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, I think historically in this tournament, you've seen younger players do very, very well in this tournament, in this format, and then kind of parlay that playing experience into a starting opportunity in that Major League Soccer. The hardest part for young players or established players that aren't playing game in, game out, is to get ready for reserve league games. I mean, it's just very, very difficult to get up. They see that as more of a punishment as opposed to an opportunity. So when you're able to travel, when you're able to get that feel that you're a first team player, that, you know, this is a quote unquote international opportunity to put yourself in the shop window, I think the players grasp it with both hands. And I think that's what you're seeing for these young players for the LA Galaxy.
Now, the Galaxy will obviously be in the next round in the knockout stages of CONCACAF Champions League. A big, long break, though, between the end of the group stages and the knockout stages. Do you expect Bruce, when it comes to the knockout, to once again start bringing in the key players from his first team squad to ensure progression? Or do you think it's right and will he stick with the kids?
No, I think the kids are out the window and the big boys are back in. I think, again, once you go from the group stage, even though it's unforgiving, and you transition into a knockout round of quarterfinals, semifinals, finals, it's the group stage, you're expected to win as an MLS team, as long as you don't face a Mexican club. Mm. Now you get into the business portion of this tournament. It's a little bit more difficult. One of the reasons why MLS is starting a little bit earlier, to give MLS teams a better opportunity to get games, get fitness, get a little bit more tactical sharpness before they head into facing either a very good team like Olimpia from Honduras or what has historically been a Saprissa from Costa Rica, if it wasn't a Mexican squad. And the good thing in this time around with CONCACAF Champions League is there's no team running away with it. There's no Monterrey. There's no Santos Laguna. There's not a huge goal differential. So I think it's a better opportunity for MLS teams to avoid a big Mexican club in the quarterfinal stage, which will be huge, because that home and away series will buy you essentially another 3 to 4 weeks to get ready for facing a Mexican team.
And there's potentially still some Mexican sides that can go out and obviously haven't booked their place in yet in the final stages. I mean, you look at, for instance, Club America. They're taking on in their group Sporting San Miguelito and Alajuelense. And America haven't dominated this group as expected. Is it a sign that we keep talking about this in CONCACAF Champions League football, but is Mexican club football getting weaker, or are they just not as bothered by CONCACAF Champions League, and instead it's more about Copa Lib and Copa Sudamericana?
Yeah, I think that's it, more than anything. I think, quite honestly, some of these clubs in Mexico, they don't take it seriously. Santos Laguna and Monterrey absolutely do. I think historically Pumas has taken it seriously. But outside of that, I think it's more of a curse than a blessing for these clubs to take part in CONCACAF Champions League. And a reason why you'll see not reserve teams being put out, but essentially under 23 teams being put out by a majority of the Mexican clubs that don't respect it. So They'll learn the hard way, and more than anything, it'll be an ego bruise for them in the short term. In the long term, they won't care. But yeah, I think honestly, that's kind of the formula for some of these Mexican teams that aren't taking it seriously. They're going to roll out the young kids, hope to get them experience, and hope for the best. And if it doesn't work, they're truthfully not really going to care that much.
In that sense, then, with the Major League Soccer sides kind of playing the reserve teams, at least in these group stages and whatnot, we saw it with the Houston Dynamo as well in their 2-0 win 2 days ago. Yesterday evening, actually. And the Mexican side's treating it like that. Is there ever, do you think, going to be a call, Brian, from Major League Soccer sides to say, why not let us, we're head and shoulders above the Honduran sides, the Panamanian sides, etc. Why not let us have a go at Copa Libertadores or Copa, maybe not Copa Sudamericana, but because Mexican sides obviously are able to enter it, and the US, you know, are just a border away from that?
To be honest with you, I think it's a travel issue. I think that it would be very, very interesting from a player's perspective to be involved in that competition. But what it comes down to, again, is the conversations that I've had with coaches is we don't get fired or hired based on CONCACAF Champions League or Copa Sudamericana. We get fired on that alone. And Major League Soccer, excuse me, they feel like their accountability is with MLS alone. And I agree with them. It is, and rightfully so. If you could figure out a way to financially make it feasible for the players, for the club to enter that tournament and ultimately open up the roster sizes, I think it makes it much more interesting. Because of right now, the difference between a Mexican salary structure, top to bottom, and the infrastructure necessary is there. For Major League Soccer, it's not. And it's one of the reasons why I've been calling for this for a long time. We're at the point in Major League Soccer where the salary cap needs to be $5 million per team. There's a lot of mechanisms that allow teams to go out and find players and essentially hide players and hide their salary. But I think the books should be open. We should be to the point where we've got the soccer-specific stadiums for the most part. We're on an upward trend. I know the television revenue is going to be the huge argument because that's where the money is made, or not made in MLS's case. But to get to that next level, I think you got to spend the money. And now it's time to open up the war chest. Cooler heads should prevail, and there should be an accountability from the top to the bottom to recognize that if we want to win the FIFA World Cup, if we want to enter these bigger tournaments, you have to give coaching staffs and organizations the opportunity to go out and find the players and subsidize their salary the right way. And unless you do that, you're just spinning your wheels and you're just talking.
But surely opening up salary caps, expanding budgets, and is always going to entice more players to come from outside the US into Major League Soccer rather than finding homegrown talent.
Yeah, and by that I still mean that homegrown talents are incredibly essential, but I think as important as we are talking about developing MLS team or MLS players, I think we also have to be open to the idea of selling these young players and capitalizing. You know, you've seen a little bit more of that lately, but a guy like Jeff Cameron, who's 26 years of age, and slides seamlessly into the right back position for Stoke City, you know, that's a good thing for us. That is a fantastic thing for Major League Soccer. We should be an import-export league. And I think that's where you develop, because for young kids to develop, you have to challenge them by putting them around amazing players. And I know what it was like as a young player in this league, being around guys that had this incredible international experience. And it forced you to step up. It forced you to develop as a player. Not physically, not just physically, but also egotistically. Because you never wanted to be the guy that David Beckham was going to yell at because you botched up a simple pass or a simple buildup. You wanted the guy that David Beckham was giving plaudits to in the press, saying, man, keep an eye on this kid. He's the next up-and-coming guy. So it works in both scenarios, and I think it's important to continue to see, you know, that import-export, that develop, and take advantage of the amount of money that's out there for young American players. Because I think I think what that old mechanism and thought was, he's an American. He's a good soccer player, but he's American. I don't think that matters anymore with what we've seen and how far we've come over the last 10 years with, you know, the young American international.
It's obviously a game that's growing in the US, and Major League Soccer is getting ever more popular. I'm going to use the San Jose Earthquakes to seamlessly weave us in, Brian, from CONCACAF Champions League into Major League Soccer. The Earthquakes are on the cusp, really, of both playoff positions and of going through from Group 5 in CONCACAF Champions League. Yet, for all fits and purposes, it's been a pretty dire year for them after such an explosive year last year. What's gone wrong with San Jose this season, Brian? Do you think they have the ability to still pull it all off at the end of the year?
Yes. To answer your final two questions, yes, I do, both in Major League Soccer and in CONCACAF Champions League. The simple answer is they're healthy. The realistic answer, and I've been saying this for a long time, is nothing has changed for San Jose outside of the fact that they just stopped scoring goals. Wondolowski last year had 27 goals. Lenhart had 13 goals. And if I'm not mistaken, Gordon had around 14 or 15 goals. Chavez, I want to say, had something like 13, 14 assists. Simon Dawkins had 8 goals coming out of the midfield. That's the only thing that changed. They were a leaky team defensively last year, and they've stayed the exact same this year. They give up unnecessary goals. I think they've settled in a little bit more with Clarence Gibson. But Victor Bernardes has been a liability. He's been a liability since he's got to Major League Soccer. He's big, he's strong, he's physical, but he gets caught up within the game. And you know, nothing's really changed. John Bush has been hung out to dry time and time again. There's nothing that's changed except they stopped scoring goals. And I think you saw that last year when the LA Galaxy went up to San Jose and Robbie Keane and Landon Donovan just cut them open. That game, they didn't score. And that whole Goonies never say die mentality, it's still there. That team will still battle. They got size. They got strength in the air with Gordon and Lenhart. They've got movement off the ball with Wondolowski. But if they don't score, you're in trouble because, San Jose is gonna give you a good 3 or 4 decent goal-scoring opportunities during a game. And Victor Bernardes is good for one big mistake each and every game. I think they're starting to round into form, and I think you're starting to see Lenhart and Gordon healthy. Chris Wondolowski's just been forced to do it by himself this year, and he hasn't had the same service that he's had last year.
Wondo, obviously a bit of a come down after the year he had last year, Brian. Just finally, before we let you go, because we've taken up plenty of your time already, Brian, but just one last quick one, is the New York Red Bulls. Always a side in Major League Soccer that are considered the nearly team. So much expectation from them, yet never quite able to do it. This season, though, they seem to have got over that hump, if you will, sat on top of the Eastern Conference and looking like a real powerhouse going into the playoffs finally, rather than maybe dribbling out at the end of the season, as we have sometimes seen.
Yeah, and it's a huge surprise, I think, for everyone, considering Mike Pecky was... I think shock and awe was going around the Major League Soccer circles when they named Pecky head coach. A great guy, an incredibly fierce competitor as a player, but not a lot of coaching experience. He handled some of the reserve stuff, but was primarily transitioning still from being a player to being a coach. So to see him have full reins, the best move that was made was they brought in Rod Frazier. You have a guy with coaching experience, with league experience, and incredibly brilliant with his tactics and his defensive shape and how he works with players. So I am incredibly happy for them. I think the reports of Thierry Henry mixing it up with Mike Pecky and then subsequently his benching and how he handled it publicly was the best case scenario for that club, and ultimately I think was a motivating factor for the success they've had recently. But I just truthfully don't believe that there's going to be a team out of the East that's going to win the MLS Cup. I don't think they're good enough. I think that conference is incredibly weak. It's been Jekyll and Hyde all season long from every single team. And I just don't think there's a team that's good enough to be consistent in the playoffs, which isn't about the games, it's about the war of attrition.
It's going to be the Sounders. I hear what you're saying, Brian. I very much hear what you're saying. Thank you so much, mate, for joining us here on World Football Daily. We know you're busy travelling about the place today, and I know you want to get home, so we will let you get off and back and on your way back home before you have to head off once again around the States to cover more football. But we do appreciate the time, mate, and we look forward to catching up with you very soon indeed.
I appreciate it, man. As always, let me know. I love talking with you guys.
Cheers, Brian. Thanks so much. We'll get you on ASAP. But for now, that was Brian Dunseth joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things Major League Soccer. And of course, big game coming up for the Portland Timbers against the LA Galaxy. A nice acid test for them as they head into the playoffs. Finally, the Timbers getting a season right after such a disappointing year last year when there was so much expectation on them. And really showing the Pacific Northwest how they roll, if you will. Unfortunately for them, it's all been about the Seattle Sounders and this excellent finish. They've got two games in hand over most teams around them, or at least one game in hand over everybody in Major League Soccer at the moment. The Sounders, 50 points. Only the Red Bulls have more in the Eastern Conference. And the Sounders looking good to finish strong. Just 8 losses this season. 5 losses, though, for the Portland Timbers. So it's going to be a Pacific Northwest Western Conference this season. I'd love to see a Sounders Timbers showdown. I think that will be an absolutely incredible atmosphere for the Western Conference final. We're going to follow Major League Soccer as it continues this season. But for now, big thanks to Brian, a big thanks to Andy Brassel as well for joining us here on World Football Daily. There are fixtures taking place tonight in CONCACAF Champions League as well. I will say, on personal note, I do have a very, very late night this evening because
I saw that.
Yeah, I am reporting on a bit of the CONCACAF Champions League tonight. I'm doing Sporting San Miguelito taking on Alajuelense. So it's going to be, I'm going to be pretty tired, ref, tomorrow. I'm not going to lie. I think I'll be home at about 6 o'clock in the morning. So
it's too bad they didn't give you, like, you know, a good game like the Galaxy. Could you imagine if they gave you the Galaxy and how you would smash that out of the park? Well, you'd be like, dude, are you kidding me? I know this team.
I was going to have the Galaxy last night. I was actually offered the Galaxy game yesterday evening. Unfortunately, I was doing a Copa Sudamericana game until after the Galaxy kicked off. So if it had been a slightly earlier kickoff, I'd have been doing the Galaxy as well from last night. I did the Galaxy last year, man, in the CONCACAF Champions League semifinal.
I'm just saying, I think, obviously, you know, any MLS team, your general knowledge of the league and its players is impressive for an Englishman. I'm just giving you a little bit of credit. That's all.
I'm sorry, what, for an Englishman?
For an English man.
I find that almost insulting, considering that, that we invented the game, and you think that, of course, we're going to have a better knowledge than you of all things football, Raf. I mean,
even if it's a league that's your own, trust me, I know your league.
Talking of a league of our own and a league of my own, I guess, we had plenty of action from around Europe. Big thanks to Andy for catching up with some of that from yesterday evening. I don't really mind where you want to start. Do you want to kick off with Luis Suarez and the return to Old Trafford? Do you want to kick off with conspiracy theories around Real Madrid again? I mean, there's...
Well, if you don't mind, I'd really like to kind of start really broad first and kind of really far out there. That way, we can always focus in on whatever else you want to go to next. Oh. But I did kind of come up with this thought yesterday while I was, you know, reading through my papers, my websites and stuff like that. Okay. Obviously, well, I mean, maybe not obviously. I guess first question would be, has there ever been a World Cup like the Qatar World Cup that has had such buildup and like this almost instant disappointment or worry, you know, that something's going to go wrong, that it can't happen there, that it, you know, has it ever been another World Cup like that, you know?
One, but only because we were hosting a World Cup in somewhere that didn't give a damn about football at the time. I mean, you know,
right?
No,
that makes sense. That makes sense. But was it? Did it go across the papers? Like, are you reading it? Like, you know, were you reading that years before the tournament kicked off? Like, this is. I mean, I can't remember when.
But there hasn't, Raph. It's because there hasn't had to be a World Cup where we've actually genuinely thought about changing and interfering with the World Cup kind of schedule so much as to need to move it to winter or anything like that. And of course, the bribery and financial implications of hosting a World Cup, of bidding for a World Cup, and the alleged bribery scandal that continues and will always continue to roll around FIFA and its upper echelons and of its executive committee. So that's why it's all come out now. And it's also because of the kind of 24/7 media that we have on it. You know, there's a guaranteed demand for, you know, sports news day in, day out, and everybody wants an update on every news story kind of on the hour, a brand new kind of twist on it. So everybody kind of continues to follow this, and rightfully so, because it's a big story in terms of changing a World Cup. I mean, obviously, it's so early. But as well, Raf, there's so much time and preparation goes into actually hosting a World Cup. It's not like, you know, it's very difficult to pull it off well on the flick of a switch kind of in the last few final hours. You know, if that's why, if they're going to change it, if they're going to sort it out, it needs to be done extremely early to allow everybody else to prepare and work out a contingency plan around it. So that's why that Raf, there's never going to have been another World Cup like this in terms of the amount of hubbub surrounding it. But that's because of the times that we live in, Raf. The way that money dictates the football so much, and the way media kind of dictates football so much as well. It's always going to be a slightly odd World Cup, I think, this Qatar one, especially the fact that as soon as they announced hosting it, you know, and then as soon as they had the allegations of bribery, and it was always going to roll on from there, So it's no surprise, Rafa, and there is no World Cup, I think, that's had a build up quite like this.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I think it was, you know, yesterday, you constantly have like various FAs and hierarchies of football all around the world kind of giving their two cents on the whole, you know, matter on whether or not they would be okay with the move of a schedule or not.
Rightfully so. It affects every single every single kind of footballing organization that has a chance of competing in the World Cup.
Completely agree. And now, but like, you know, like I'm seeing this morning about some slaves report, basically kind of giving a report on the condition of workers for you know, for those people who are working on the general infrastructure for the upcoming World Cup, which, you know, obviously needs to get going kind of right now, I'm sure. So you know,
well, it's no surprise if they're talking about the kind of work conditions and the work conditions being terrible and all this sort of thing, because it's long been known as well, you know, places like Dubai, there's a very strong expat community out there, and it's very easy to get sucked in just the expat community. But there's been a number of exposés and documentaries and reports from Dubai about the locals, about how things are changing to accommodate the expat community that people don't like, and how as well there's kind of these workers that come from the Philippines who almost stay in like kind of shantytown type things, and they're kind of not seen and not heard this part of Dubai, and while the expats kind of roam around with, you know, having a housemaid that pretty much gets ended up by some people treated almost like a slave and whatnot, there's this kind of work community that you know does end up suffering because of that. I mean, it's all very obviously very kind of political and not much to do with the football, but that kind of comes into it when you're talking about hosting a World Cup, and the discussion around human rights and racism and whatnot is always going to be brought up if you're going to be hosting one of the world's kind of greatest tournaments. And there's obviously a lot of talk around Qatar and in terms of that, and of course the homophobia debate that has obviously become very prominent in recent years in football as well. And especially in recent months, with the announcement from Robbie Rogers that he is gay, and obviously the shoelaces campaign that we saw last weekend taking place and whatnot. So there's plenty of political aspects that go into hosting a World Cup, and this isn't something, Raf, that's going to be discussed now and not talked about later. This is going to be going on right up until the final hours before the start of the World Cup, and throughout the tournament as well. I guarantee during the Qatar World Cup there are going to be exposés, and there are going to be people giving their stories of how they were arrested for having a beverage in their hotel, but maybe having one too many, or maybe for kind of what the Qataris might deem inappropriate affection in a public area and these sorts of things. And it's going to continue throughout the tournament as well, whether that's in winter or summer, Raf. This is a storm that isn't going to die down as we head towards the World Cup. It's only going to get bigger and bigger and grow and grow and grow, unless the World Cup's moved away from Qatar or something. No, that's pretty much the only way that I can think, unless Qatar kind of relinquishes its World Cup. It's going to have this sort of media storm surrounding it. Now, whether, you know, there's no such thing as bad news, supposedly. So maybe the Qataris are loving the fact that there's so much attention being brought to their country and whatnot. You never know. You just don't know what's going on 100%. What we do know is that we have a World Cup in Qatar at the moment. We still don't know if it's going to be winter or summer. We will be finding that out in early October, when the FIFA Executive Committee gets together and there's a big discussion about what's going to be done with the Qatar situation. And as I say, it's going to keep continuing to the World Cup. To be honest, it's quite a sour note, because as much as, you know, some people love talking about politics, and, you know, I'm not going to lie, I did a politics degree at university, but at the same time, when it comes to football, we'd like it not to have all these outside factors in it. You know, not that the issues aren't important when they do crop up in football, but it would just be nice to be able to talk about just the game and the game alone. And there is so much else that comes with football these days that this sort of, I don't want to say baggage, because that makes it sound like we're being very flippant with it, because it's not baggage. They're not flippant issues that are being discussed. But it would be nice just to kind of stick to what takes place on the pitch, rather than having so many kind of offshoots of conversation off the pitch to get into the politics of the game and politics of life in general.
Sure. I was going to say that in general, it's nice, you know, so some of the things about the World Cup is that, like, you know, you just learn so much about that country, about that place. You kind of feel like, you know, you're vacationing there a little bit. Like, every World Cup that I've experienced, even the one that was here, you know, like, I felt like I was going to, you know, the Detroit Dome. I felt like I was going to, the Rose Bowl. I felt like I was in all these arenas, all these venues across the States. And there's just so much to kind of experience that you can kind of positively take from pulling this World Cup off. It's really kind of sad that, you know, like you said, there's just a ton of just kind of black cloud and negative comments going around this whole World Cup.
Yeah, and it won't get used to it, Ref. You know, get used to it. It won't be going for a very long time. Talking of negativity, Ref, what did you make of the LA Galaxy's team selection last night?
Well, I mean, I feel like they're on top of their group. They're on top of that situation. I think they're feeling pretty comfortable and probably.
Well, they're qualified now, obviously, 3 wins from 3 games, one more game left to play. Cartagena's 5 points behind them and have already played their 4 games. Isidro Metapan on 1 point so far. And it's a comfortable group for them. We're talking with Brian about it. But do you not think that... I don't know, why can the LA Galaxy, with a team full of... And obviously, no Costa Rican side, for instance, is going to have the whole of the Costa Rican national team in it or anything like that. But why do the US men's national team, who have a stronger team than the LA Galaxy, struggle in Costa Rica, yet the LA Galaxy can send out pretty much their reserve side to Cartagena's and dominate on Costa Rican home soil? Like, why is the away fixture problem a problem for the US men's national team, but not for these sides in CONCACAF Champions League? As I say, I know the squad kind of differences aren't as strong, but you could argue that the Cartagena squad is, you know, as weak as the LA Galaxy's reserve squad was to the US men's national team last night.
Sure. I mean, I don't know. This group, I've seen Isidro Metapan before, but as for Cartagena's, I really haven't. Gio kind of reported to me that they were a pretty soft side.
Like Seattle soft, Ref, because if you're saying
beyond,
Seattle soft, that's pretty
Seattle
strong.
Soft. No, beyond Seattle soft. All like right. I'm thinking DC United, like last season soft.
Yeah, yeah.
But seriously, Like just
Chivas USA soft kind of.
Oh yeah, yeah. There you go. That's soft. But Chivas again. I feel like Chivas have talent. The Cartagines or whatever. I'm not seeing any talent. I haven't watched much of that game or of their games because I don't really feel like they're a challenge. And so I think, especially with the finish line kind of coming in sight for the season for MLS, I think Bruce Arena is trying to get. He is the Fergie, I think, of American soccer coaching. To be honest, I think he's trying to just build experience with players, keep that continual growth of the club. Like, it's not just about one season or this season or the next season. It's about constantly growing your club, your assets and players. You know, the way that they groomed Mike McGee and brought him up and had such success with him, and then, you know, kind of was able to use him in a deal to send to Chicago, and he's still successful. You know what I mean? Like, it's not they do a really good job with developing players, and I think that this is just kind of part of that. I think that they, you know, by having these players getting quote unquote big time game experience, and say whatever you want about this. This is essentially a Champions League match for these guys.
Well, it's not essentially. I mean, it is. It is a Champions League match.
Yeah, actually, absolutely. Fact. It is called a CONCACAF Champions League match. It may not be the Champions League that I think most Americans think about, you know? And we always think first off about the European Champions League. I think that's just a given. But they do kind of understand the weight and the gravity of it, and I think that as American soccer supporters, we also do a really good job of building it up and you know, showing our appreciation. Well, not showing our appreciation, because hardly very many people come to those games here in the States during the midweek. But I mean, it's debatable. I do think that we do kind of hold the clubs to the standard of saying that this is the, you know, you should want to win this. I just understand what Bruce Arena was doing, and I think that it's part of the success of the Los Angeles Galaxy as a club.
Fair enough. It just frustrates me how the US men's national team struggles so much when they go away, yet. Like, aside from San Jose this year, the other three US sides in CONCACAF Champions League are unbeaten at the moment. It's like, well, come on, like, really, why can't the US emulate their weaker Major League Soccer brothers and go away from home? And
you got to think that all these clubs from wherever they're coming from in Central and South America or Central America, like, their talent's got to be shipped out. Like, that's it's just got to be shipped out, right? Like, who wants to be playing for Isidro Metapan? Who wants to be playing for Cartagines? You know, who wants to be playing for Alajuelense Rize? I would play for Tijuana. And you know what? Like, you see Americans playing in Tijuana. That's something that happens. Fact. But CD Victoria,
That's what I mean. Like, these Major League Soccer sides, because you get US men's national team players, a lot of them play overseas. These US soccer sides aren't packed with the best of the best, yet they can still go to teams in Panama that have a scattering of maybe national team players in them. Because obviously there aren't many Panamanian players that are flooded around the world type thing, although the cream of the crop are, of course, as with Costa Rica, Honduras, etc. But, you know, these Major League Soccer sides aren't taking. You look at the Galaxy last night; they aren't taking a huge team, for instance, away from home. Yet they're still getting their job done comfortably. If it's an excuse for the US men's national team, but it's not an excuse for Major League Soccer when they go away. These kind of being on the road, being in different countries, different pitches, etc., and they get less time to acclimatize as well. It's to me, it's the US men's national team picking up straws. Anyway, Let's move.
What did you want to talk about with Manchester United, Liverpool? I'll give you my opinion, or I'll answer any kind of questions you might have.
Well, I still don't understand why Javier Hernandez isn't given far more playing time at Manchester United. That's the big question that I really have, is Hernandez, and really shouldn't this guy be given more game time?
It's racism against Mexicans, man. I'm telling you, bro.
You reckon it's an anti...
Viva la raza, ese.
Viva the rats. Viva the rata. Is that what you say? What? Man, that's not cool. You can't be saying stuff like that. It's very not cool. No, Javier Hernandez, right? Look at his goal scoring record since coming into the league, okay? He's made, since joining Manchester United, his first season he made 15 starts, second season 18, and last season 9, okay? The rest of his appearances coming from the bench, of course. 22 appearances overall last season, 28 and 27 the seasons before that. Yet, goals, 13, 10, 10. Okay? So he's averaging at least a goal every three games. And he's not even starting the majority of these games, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why is this guy not playing more first-team football at Manchester United? Why is he not giving more of a shot? Everybody said last night, oh, isn't that classic Javier Hernandez finish? You know, just poaching, being there at the right place at the right time, finding that space, finding that cross, and the technique to open up his body like that, that was a world-class finish. You know, the ball's coming across him, it's on his weaker foot, it was shaping like it could be on his weaker foot, and instead he jumps back, opens up his body and gets the perfect little side nod onto it and puts it past Mignolet in the Liverpool goal. I'm sorry, but this guy has a finisher's touch. He can head, he can shoot, he can play off players so well. He is a player who, look, I know you've got Robin van Persie and you've got Wayne Rooney, and with those players, you have to find a way to get them in the squad more. But I seriously think like a front three of Van Persie, Hernandez and Rooney sitting off just behind them. And I know he hates playing deep, but suck it up, because this boy, Javier Hernandez, is quality in front of goal. You know, if you've got Van Persie hitting the long range efforts and Hernandez mopping up with any any fumbles from keepers or anything low driven in across goal, we're talking goals, goals, goals here for Manchester United. I think he brings more spark than Danny Welbeck. I think easily saw that last night. Why not Hernandez?
You know, I honestly don't know. My one kind of maybe concern or thought that comes to mind is that I generally kind of remember seeing tired performances by Chicharito when he plays full games, and or like he gets a little bit lost when he's playing for the full 90. I guess I feel like he gets lost, in my opinion. And that's just kind of the way that I guess see it. Maybe that's the excuse. Maybe they're dangling playing time in front of him, knowing that he's going to be that much more hungry when he comes on. I don't know why he's not starting more. I really don't.
Well, as I say, I think we all know why, is because of Van Persie and Rooney, and unfortunately, and obviously Danny Welbeck as well. And unfortunately, it is just proving too tough for Hernandez to get himself a starting place in this Manchester United side. Has he done enough to deserve maybe a starting spot on the weekend, though? Getting the winning goal against Liverpool last night. And really, that's a result that saves David Moyes' bacon quite a bit, doesn't it? You know, after the massive loss on the weekend to Manchester City, the dismal performance against Chelsea, a big result, and obviously losing to Liverpool earlier in the season as well, big result against Liverpool, at least in the Capital One Cup, is a nice little break just to ease some pressure off David Moyes' back. Arsenal getting through against West Bromwich Albion last night. It took penalties, but the Baggies unable to hold Arsenal pretty much reserves. Nice though to see Nacho Monreal back, Thomas Vermaelen back as well, Jenkinson and Mertesacker, a solid back four from Arsenal played last night, and then a mix of some of the rough around the edges players, including Nicholas Bentner back in the Arsenal squad as well. Not an impressive night though for Nicky Bentner, but what were we expecting? And crushingly, if it wasn't bad enough that Birmingham City beat Sheffield Wednesday on the weekend, they then go and knock out one of my favourite teams in English football at the moment. Swansea City beaten 3-1 at St Andrews last night. Disappointing result for the Swans. Very much.
I guess they're not going to.
No repeat this year. No repeat
this week.
No. But I mean, you know, it's a reserve side from Swansea. I think the league is the priority. You know, living off that cup result last year will be enough for Loudrup, I think, going into it. There was, you know, plenty of action all over the place last night, Raf. For Liverpool, have you seen enough for them so far in this season that you genuinely think they can stay up with the bigger boys in the Premier League?
I think that they can compete for the league for a while. I'm not sure how deep they go, but you know, from what I'm getting from most Liverpool fans, generally reading across the papers and such, I'm feeling like it was almost an optimistic win. I think that, you know, they're not so depressed with the way that you know, Suarez performed. I think that they're definitely excited about the fact that Suarez is still an ambitious player. He's still a talented and capable player. And the pairing of Suarez and Sturridge is something that they can kind of bank on.
Yeah, that was last night, really. That was a United second team taking on a Liverpool first team without Coutinho, wasn't it? You know, you look at that lineup: Toure, Skrtel, Sakho, Enrique, Gerrard, Lucas, Moses, Henderson, Suarez, Sturridge. Now, when you take Victor Moses out and put Coutinho in, that's Liverpool's starting 11. Whereas yesterday, for United, De Gea, yeah, okay, starts most games. Smalling started on the weekend. Rooney started on the weekend. Hernandez barely played this year. Kagawa barely played this year. Nani barely played this year. Butner barely played this year. Johnny Evans making his first start this year. I mean, for Moyes, he'll be looking back at this result and thinking,
a very talented and gifted side from United in general. I mean, I look at every player that you name from United, and they're almost all internationals.
But surely that's why Liverpool, there's no chance of them competing with the big boys this season, because there isn't that depth. Last night they went up against a United B squad and ended up losing. Now, it wasn't a drumming. They weren't like smashed out of the park, and Liverpool really actually had chances and probably should have and deserved maybe an equaliser in that game. But the fact is they didn't, and they lost to a United B side that pretty much was had David De Gea and Wayne Rooney as your only kind of guaranteed main starters in that side.
I think that, you know, Liverpool will be more than capable of handling any other sides. I mean, it's not about, I don't know. I think that they'll be able to get draws with your Uniteds, your Chelseas, your Arsenals. They can beat an Arsenal on their day. And the rest of the league, I think Brendan Rodgers will do a very good job of keeping them up and keeping them, you know, focused on getting points. And that's going to kind of come into play, much like Fergie was able to get his team up for every single game and get those, you know, gritty 1-0s and you know, tough draws in the last moments and stuff. Every point counts, and Brendan Rodgers knows that. I think that he's going to have this team competing throughout the entire season. Again, I mean, there was the first thing that I admitted. I'm just not sure how deep they go, and that's going to kind of be the determining factor of how far that team can go.
We shall see. The Capital One proved to have a few thrills and spills left in it last night, and of course all the attention was on Luis Suarez and his return, and Liverpool will take on Sunderland this weekend. So Raf, I guess we will see how much you think Liverpool and how far you think Liverpool can go in IKTS tomorrow on the show. Just finally, let's finish off on an English note then, Raf. Juan Mata, rumours that everybody across Europe is lining up to pick him away from Chelsea. Do you really think Juan Mata is going to be leaving Chelsea come January?
I don't see why not. I mean, especially if he's not getting the play that he wants, and there's going to be plenty of time to kind of see whether or not, you know, Jose's going to use him or not in his scheme. So I wouldn't put it off, you know, and the fact that if there are other Champions League teams, especially competing Champions League teams, willing to kind of pay for him, I mean, sure, get some first team play. He's a talented player.
It would be a massive loss for Chelsea, though, if they lost.
Absolutely. No, I mean, it would be ridiculous. I would hate, I mean...
Player of the season 2 years in a row and then can't tie it out, hold down a starting position and can't and ends up getting shipped out after half a year under Mourinho. Is this Mourinho being too controversial again, as we saw with at Madrid?
I don't know.
Maybe an anti-Spain thing coming here once again. Mourinho a little bitter about it?
Potentially, but I'm not sure what it is. But Mourinho does seem to be kind of slipping up quite a bit this season, and I'm definitely finding myself questioning a lot of his decisions and tactics and the way that he's, you know, approaching games and reacting to games as well.
It's not so happy for the special one, but Chelsea will continue to rock and roll through this season. Give us your thoughts on whether Juan Mata will be or should be leaving. I can imagine there's going to be plenty of people saying no. On Twitter, at WFootballDaily, on the emails as well, show at worldfootballdaily.com, Facebook page, of course, and the rant line 310-909-8483. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll be looking at a little bit of fantasy football, and of course I know the score as well. We'll be looking ahead to more of the games coming up this weekend. For now though, we will see you on, as they say, in the hood, on the flip side, I believe it is. A big thanks to Andy Brassel and of course to Brian Dunseth for joining us on the show today. Raf, a big thanks to you as always, and a big thanks, of course, actually the most important bit of thanks really, to our listeners who've been sticking with us and the new listeners who have been joining us recently as well. Welcome to World Football Daily. On that note, we will see you at the same time tomorrow. Enjoy the football tonight. Inter against Fiorentina is going to be an absolute cracker. Cannot wait to get into it. We will talk about it tomorrow on the show. Take care. Have a good one. Enjoy the football.